was you know, on the disruptive ones, one of the things I have to use is to help me understand where I have interpreted somebody's comment negatively, you know, and I'm already ready for a fight. You know, there was enough ambiguity. Remember our conversation last week about if there's anything ambiguous, we'll tend to take it negatively and assume that they're assaulting us, right? And you try to learn to calm down one, and then they ask, I have obviously misunderstood what you just said, you know, because I read it this way, you know. And I know that tells you more about me than about what you said, but to help me understand, what did you mean? Help me understand that. If you can get to where you can pause long enough to give the benefit of the doubt to ask that question, half the spiritual battle is over about responding in anger and not being disclosive. Remember, when somebody insults us like that, or we interpret that as an insult, our tendency is to flame up in anger but not necessarily go resolve the issue. We'll attack instead of, you know, use that passion that says something's out of whack here and say, okay, Lord, that tells me I need to go clear something up in love and faithfulness, something like that. But I know that's something I have to constantly do. That's a different kind of deception. That's a deception that's in human relationships, but it's still a very, very real one that comes up in dealing with, as I use the phrase, other humans, as a recluse. So, let's open with a word of prayer for our session two here. Father, we come before you. We still our hearts. We are totally dependent upon you. Basil mentioned, fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. We got to start there. We start in our trust of you that you would protect us from deception, self-deception. We can see by the cross the immensity of your love for us. There was just no deception there. I mean, there's just no ambiguity at all about the expression of your love in the person of your Son. We may interpret the things in our lives in different ways of trauma and tragedy. Sometimes it's wondering if you're there or if you care, and things of this type. And these things have this ambiguous character sometimes, but one cannot look at the cross and have any doubts about the extent of your love. It is very clear, the extent of your action on our behalf to clear the way, clear the obstacles of sin, judgment between us and you, that we can come to know you because of what your Son did. So we ask as when we look into this stuff this morning, we understand how you do protect us so immensely and consistently and lovingly against so many of these areas that are arraigned against us. We ask that we would become more appreciative, more responsive, and more trusting, more like the little children that we're supposed to be toward you, Father, that we could dance and delight in your presence. We ask this for your Son's sake, that he would be honored more by how we spend our time and our thoughts this morning. Now, we have been talking about an area that is relatively strange to the Western world. We've been talking about angels and demonic forces. And we actually haven't talked much about demonic forces because we've been talking about bad angels. And they're slightly different, as far as we can tell, from the demonic presence. We have a tremendous amount of evidence for the existence of the demonic. I literally wrote an article on the tank this week, posted it out there Tuesday for those of you that want data on this, about disembodied intelligences, you know, from anthropology and psychiatry and these areas where they're real. They're out there. Fortunately, in our world, God protects, keeps that at a statistical minimum. We don't have lots of that. Our world is chaotic enough just dealing with humans. Fallen humans like ourselves. And so we are very thankful and appreciative that that's not a tremendous element of unpredictability in our lives. But it is very, very real. And it is out there at the fringes of experience, but it is in Indiana. This stuff happens in Indiana, as far into the country as that may be, right? But it happens, and we have to deal with this. And that tips us off, if nothing else, that tips us off that we are not the highest creatures in this universe. when all of a sudden an alien intelligence can take over a body and speak foreign languages, perfect in dialect, that person could never know, or would know information about me, my personal and private life, or somebody that's there, that there'd be no way that they could know. You know that you're no longer the big kid on the block. And if there are powerful intelligences above us that we have no ability to protect ourselves against, that certainly manifest greater power and certainly greater knowledge than us, we must immediately start to hope is that there's a bigger one. We had better start hoping. The sane reaction to that is we had better hope that there's a God and that He's good-hearted. That He's good-hearted. And what we have been looking through is that the God of the Judeo-Christian tradition in which we stand, that sent Jesus, has told us in the Old Testament about the context in which we live. And one of the contexts in which we live is that there are good angels and bad angels. And that, as Basil, they don't just pick on Basil. They don't like humans. They don't like us. And they are arraigned against us. And what we've studied so far, if we looked at biblical passages, we looked at how the Jews understood this in the rabbinical literature, that they can judge us. They do have some kind of authority over us in this planet. And they are quick to judgment. They are quick to judgment. They like, and they're legitimate in the judgment. When I do something wrong, I mean, when a human does something wrong, it's a, you know, the law of consequences is supposed to work. There's supposed to be something like that. But they apparently like what they do. On point 11, we were on page 10, where we're going to resume in just a minute. On point 11, I just quoted from Jewish literature, you know, of the time, how they saw the angels. And they said that, yes, they don't give us a chance like God likes to do. God likes to give us a chance. When we mess up, God doesn't want to immediately judge us. You know, I mean, He knows it's wrong. We're supposed to know it's wrong. He gives us this little time window for us to catch up to His knowledge, to catch up and say, oh, that was a mistake. You're right. I'm wrong. Chair is out of order. I should not have done that. You're right. The consequences are bad. I shouldn't have gone there. I'll try not to next time. You're absolutely right. Your view of reality is correct. Mine is less correct. And that's the goal for us, to get back up there and then become, again, looking like His character. B'nai Elohim, sons of God. We're supposed to model His character of goodness. And if you recognize something, guess what we're supposed to do to people that do the same thing to us that we do to God, right? We're supposed to cut them the benefit of the doubt, give them patience before we come down real hard there as well. As managers, you have what we call in the secular world the come to Jesus meeting. As the managers, where they come in and you have this conversation about, you know, their performance or things of this type. And sometimes we overdo this. I remember in 1986, in the middle of a personnel review that I was having of one of my project managers, I was over in what we call the developmental needs. And I might have been a little harsh or firm or strong, and the building started shaking. That was the big earthquake. That was the big earthquake. Right in the middle of this section, it started shaking, and my coffee cup spilled over into my keyboard, filled with coffee. And I thought, oh, you know, about 45 seconds in, okay, Lord, I'll back off of this. We'll give them a little more time to correct the stuff. Okay. And I learned that, you know, I didn't mean to cause all that damage. To cause the earthquake, just for, you know, real hardness. But there's a lesson in there about the catching up. And the angels, at least the bad ones, the good ones love this. Remember, they have a party every time one of us changes their mind. Remember, over one sinner that repents, whether that's Christian or none, you know, or getting into the fold or living in the fold, they have a party in heaven over the tiniest act of moral, where we show that the ruling government, the ruling bad ones, didn't win this one. That God's grace warmed a heart warm enough to do good things. And so we have the scenario where I read across in devotions this week about in Zechariah about these patrolling angels. You know, they're the ones that we think that in Job 1, where Satan was walking to and fro along the earth. Remember that passage? that one commentator said that apparently this is his job, that he is a judging angel. And that's what he roves around like a lion, seeking to devour. He's an accuser and a deceiver, remember? Well, in Zechariah, when they had these judgment angels, they had, the New American Standard translates it. They go out on patrol, they come back, and they say to God, well, everything's at peace. Nobody's getting upset here. Everything's at peace. God immediately says, okay, then I'll make a judgment. I'll do something. You can see that they're using that as an argument that it's not supposed to be like that because there's so much sin and wickedness. A chapter or two later, it says they were eager to go back on patrol. They sought to go back on patrol. They wanted to come down here and, again, do this judgment thing. It was a, there's nothing wrong with judgment. It's just that when God uses judgment, he waits way too long. And we complain about why he lets evil in the world so long. Remember? He's consistently patient with us as human. Well, we come now to step 12. Step 12. This is not a 12-step program. We're on point 12, page 10. So we've got the situation where they've got these power. Extra syllabus? Yeah, does somebody not have have one of the handouts? Because John's got some. If you don't have one of the handouts, we're on page 10. Okay. So they've got a tremendous amount of power. And point 12 is, since they do not bear the sword in vain, we're down at the bottom under point 12, they can also wield the fear of death. Remember, one of the punishments was death. They could execute us. Since they do not bear the sword in vain, they can also wield the fear of death over their charges, over us. They can terrorize their constituency with this into all kinds of religious slavery. Okay. The quote there from Hebrews 2. Since the children have flesh and blood, Christ too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is, the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Now, the fear of death is a powerful motivator. It will make you do strange things in this world. Strange things in this world. And this even showed up under, actually included the Jewish nation in their bondage to the elemental spirits of the law. So in Galatians 4:9, Paul also spoke of the Galatians, quote, observing special days and months and seasons and years. While Paul had no problem with Christians having personal convictions on such matter, in other words, you wanted to celebrate one day before the Lord, that was great. Just couldn't turn it into a law that forced everybody else to do it. This was a freedom of conscience, a celebration thing. He objected to these observances, including circumcision, being viewed as religious obligation. In other words, you had to do it as part of the necessary response to the gospel message. In Paul's mind, to turn to circumcision and legal observances was tantamount to returning to slavery, a slavery to the principalities and powers. So in other words, when you take something good and turn it into something legal, guess where, whose trap you've fallen back into? Right. See? Now, we'll get into some of the problems associated with this. And I use the three-day model. Anytime something works for me and it's beautiful that God gives me, you know, from the Scripture or something like this, and it sets me free, and it's a new way of doing something, you know, and I do it and it's wonderfully liberating and free, I can only use that like that for like 3 days before it becomes legalism. I'll apply it the next day because it worked so well yesterday. Right? Maybe I'll put God in there somewhere. Maybe God used it so well yesterday in my life. But on the third day, I'll start applying it like it's magic or it's a routine. And the fourth day, I'm dead as a doorknob spiritually at this point. Please. So that's one of the rules I use about this thing, because remember we talked over and over and over about the manna. When they went out every morning to get the manna in the wilderness, it only was good for one day. You had to go back out the next day, because if you tried to use the old manna, what did it do? It bred worms. Right? It had worms in it. So it was a little object lesson that says you go every day. You go feed every day. Right? And renewing of your minds, the Scripture calls it. It's a beautiful celebration, and he doesn't want celebrations to become rituals, dead rituals. and dead rituals have become laws, and where you start judging somebody else because they don't do it the way you do. They don't spend, they do their quiet times at night instead of in the morning. Well, you need to do it before you make all your decisions. That's not of God. You know, that kind of thing, right? And so we tend to do this for good or ill. And so here they had turned these into a slavery model. I mean, Paul had experienced this himself so personally. Remember, he says, you know, I love the law of God. And every time I start trying to obey it, something just wells up within me that says, no. My son sent me a cartoon on the internet. That was so great. It had this elderly couple at its corner. And there was a sign posted that said, machete juggling prohibited. This was just a downtown area. And the gentleman was saying to his wife, well, Ma, you know, I have all of a sudden this incredible urge to juggle machetes. Right. It's just a perfect illustration of if it says, do not covet, hey, that's a great idea. That's a great idea. It's like that, don't think of elephants. Whatever you do, don't think of elephants. You know, it's that kind of scenario. And something in us takes advantage of that. It's called the flesh, the sin nature. For Paul, both Jews and Gentiles were in bondage to the powers of darkness prior to conversion. He explained that unredeemed Jews are slaves to the elemental spirits of the universe. These hostile forces apparently exploited the law and use it as a tool to hold unbelieving Judaism in captivity. God's redemption through Christ brings freedom. Freedom from the law and freedom from servitude to the powers. Okay? That which we, if you're enslaved by something, addicted to it, and you can't get free of it, it doesn't matter how good it looks. It's not of God. His burden is easy and light. Makes your heart gentle and meek and fills it with rest. The other things just don't, they aren't of God. And like I say, at least I have not found a single good that a human cannot turn into something evil. I have not found anything. And I find more things every day as I get older. Things that are good that can go wrong. Okay? So they've got this enslavement thing that even things that are good. Point 13, inside Old Testament Israel, this deception spiral was at work from the beginning, unfortunately. And I got two quotes there from the scripture, Deuteronomy. They made God jealous with their foreign gods and angered him with their detestable idols. They sacrificed to demons, which are not God. Gods they had not known, gods that recently appeared, gods your fathers did not hear. Now, Deuteronomy 32, if you remember, this is the fifth book in the Old Testament, right? And Deuteronomy comes from Deutero, means the second, and Nomos, meaning the law. It's the second giving of the Mosaic law. So the first one comes roughly in Exodus and Leviticus, where as they're coming out of Egypt, God gives them the law, gives them the laws and the principles. And then after that whole generation dies and they're about to go into the promised land, Moses is about to die, and their little nagging conscience is going to get taken up off of the mountain to heaven instead of having to plod through the promised land. No comparison between the two, I should mention. He says, okay, let me remind you where we are, what God's done. For those of you that didn't see all the miracles, here's what happened. And so Deuteronomy is just a restatement of the law with some changes to adapt to a change in locale. They're going to no longer be wandering around in the desert. They're going to have houses to live in, kind of thing. So there's a little change there. But in 32, he's mentioning, he's telling them ahead of time, you're going to fail. You're going to fail. Here's the consequences. You're going to fail. And so Deuteronomy 32 has got this in there, and it says, here's what happened. Here's what your fathers did. They failed. They sacrificed demons. As they were coming through, they were still sacrificing to what they called the gold idols. There's a passage that said they were still offering sacrifices. During this time, where every morning they had to go out and get manna from God, you can apply this daily yourself, and then they immediately go on a regular basis and sacrifice, and they say, my highest value is associated with this non-God. My real values are here. Thank you, God. Empower me for non-service. Empower me. And there's something so out of whack about that, if you don't, you know, obviously, right? And they were doing this, right? They were doing this, and God didn't kill them every day. You know, there was a newness and renewal. He kept the people among them, etc., kept calling them. There were some beautiful things that happened during this wilderness wandering. There were some great things. There were people of faith, people of compassion. There was lots of grace that went on there. But they were still, even back then, after they came out of Egypt, they were still sacrificing to demons. And Leviticus said, "And they shall no longer sacrifice their sacrifices to the goat demons with which they play the harlot." That's that verse I was talking about. That's in Leviticus. They said, we need to stop them from doing this. They're doing this. They're getting off the track. We'll see, in the next bullet, why you don't do this. How that messes up your head. Okay? So, and as Israel sought the false gods of the nations, their openness to deception increased. And they called on Yahweh less and less. And so his involvement was less and less. And from a distance, more and more. And God gave them over to serve those foreign gods in that foreign country, Jeremiah 5:19. Now, the basic principle was the safest place to be was close to God, the real God. Oh, that's always the case. This is the God of truth, not anesthesia. He doesn't just trick you into believing something that's wonderfully, feels good, but it's not true. We don't believe in myths and fables because they make us feel good about the afterlife and stuff like this. He won't let you do that. He'll just rub your nose in the fact that this is reality. Here's truth. He's a God of truth. Those that worship him must worship in spirit, passion and heart, and in truth. John 4. Right? So there's just clarity. There's this management axiom. Clarity is to be preferred. Clarity is to be preferred. Right? You need to know where you stand. And so God is after this. And as soon as I say, well, you know, I like truth, but I only like it at about 35%. I like this other stuff that makes me feel better, lets me do what I want to do. I like to keep a healthy balance between truth and untruth in my life. That golden mean between right and wrong, to use Spiro Agnew's phrase. You know, I like right in there in the middle, right? And this was going on in our lives, non-Jewish people back there, just lots of this. And Israel, the more they said, well, you know, I'd rather be like everybody else. Remember how when they picked a king, right? They said, we don't like just having this tent here. We want a king to go lead us in battles. We don't trust God anymore. We want a king, like, so we can be like all the other nations. That's exactly what they said. You know, I mean, no bones about it. They knew, right? And this is where the wise mother would say, what? Well, if all your friends jumped off a cliff, right, would you jump off too, right? You know, right? And they would say, absolutely. We'd have fun on the way down, and that'd be it. But I wouldn't be alone with everybody over the cliff. And so they went after this, and they did the same thing about worshiping their gods. Remember Solomon's sad story about him building temples of false gods, and it just disturbed the heart. All right, so this stuff was also happening with Israel. And then we come to this bullet that I'm hoping we can get through today, 14, about why you don't do that. Then or now, why you don't go worship false gods, why you don't play with spirits and things of this type. So many reasons, but we're going to cover some of the basics. 14, the prohibition in the Old Testament against sorcery, witchcraft, divination, idolatry, and necromancy was exceptionally important to Israel's health, as it would be for anyone, to deliberately begin interaction with invisible spirits placed you in a situation in which you could not defend yourself against its power, its arguments, its influence, or its presence. When you deliberately go out there and seek an unknown God that you have not pre-qualified, it's not disclosed their heart or their goodness, it's not fed you and kept you alive all those years, you open yourself up to a tremendous ton of problems, a tremendous set of problems, because you have no control. Remember, these are beings that have... You're going to them because they have more power than you. Duh. Right? You're going to them to help you with the crops, with bad luck, help you win the lotto, things of this type. Things you can't personally do as a human. Right? Most people. Right? And that should be a tip you off that if you said, well, what happens if they don't like me? What happens if I buy their favor and they say, well, yeah, I'll give you 5 minutes of goodness, but don't bother about the fine print. You become indebted to me in a different way. If you want me in your life, remember that thing about the vampire. Don't invite them. Once they step across the threshold in the movies, and the vampire can't come into your house, right, unless you invite the vampire in, right? But once the vampire comes in, you can't get rid of them, right? It's that kind of model that once I invoke a spirit in its various forms, I may not be able to get it ever out again without help that's stronger than that force, okay? Now, so you could not defend yourself. And I got a couple of bullets here. There's a vast amount of data, historical, anthropological, and psychological, confirming the existence of demonic possession. We call it possession in the literature. And even Western descriptive sciences are admitting the failure of its science to explain it away. In almost all non-Western and ancient cultures, possession was institutionalized in the religious and shamanistic areas. Just the most 98% of the world cultures have what they call institutionalized and ritualized possession. The shaman will go into a state of trance or ecstasy, sometimes using drugs, but more often just using music, and will be possessed by some local deity. The face will change, superhuman strength, as disclosure as to what diseases are going on, just classical, and then at the end of the ceremony, and then multiple people will do this, at the end of the ceremony it all cuts off. Okay? And we thought for the longest time in Western arrogance that they were just play acting, that it was a role play, it was good therapy for them to act out these strange things. The problem was that the knowledge that they get during the trance is supernatural. There's no way that they could know some of the things that come back out of this scenario at all. There are medicinal things. They're just too much stuff that Western science can't explain about what happens in there. But it's institutionalized and approved. Okay? Approved. So it's a very, very real, and that's institutionalized. Then we get the kind that's not institutionalized, which we hear about like, regular demonic possession, the kind the media will go with, you know, those kinds of things. Those smaller cases that are not ritualized, they're not deliberate. I didn't typically ask for this, although we'll talk about how one edges toward it in a few minutes. Two, many modern possession cases, the kinds we see now, began with dabbling in the occult, Ouija boards and magic, just taking that first step, okay? These are all resources. Most of these quotes that start with the little X down there for the citation are all technical materials and surveys, scholarly stuff. Some voluntary invited possession is not a deliberate liaison with the forces of evil in the way of black magicians. You know, they openly call on evil, but an opening of doors in ignorance of the spiritual gate crashers. Okay? This has already been made clear in considering the dangers of occult involvement, whether it is psychic development, superstitious dependence, or the range of spirit activities from Ouija to seances. Ouija is alleged not to work without first an invitation to the spirit of the glass. There's the door, would you come in? And are you there? As soon as I pray with an are you there, are you there is a prayer that addresses in it some kind of theoretical intent. As soon as I do that, I'm open. I'm open to something. Is the key question of seances as well. The most specific invitation for spirit possession is by mediums who use trances during which they invite possession by an alien intelligence. And so the classic spirit, you know, the seance kind of model, they do that very deliberately. They say, I want to have contact with the spirits or whatever. So it's a deliberate opening up. Like I say, in the case of Ouija and magic and stuff like that, it's a little smaller, less more subtle, and it's not as obvious, but it still has some of those elements in it. The overwhelming factor in accidental or involuntary possession is, as has been made clear above from the cases, they gave up statistical cases, cases of known and obvious possession, and they traced them back to the causes. What were the factors in the person's life that might have been involved? The overwhelming factor was involvement with the occult, for it is basically the worship of what is created. Viewed positively, those who are immune from such suffering are those whose doors are shut to psychic, occult, magical, or demonic forces and pressures, who love God and hence live without fear. The only safety is there with God. That's the only safety. Remember that illustration about the shepherd that I love so much? That picture of the shepherd with the staff, the little sheep at the feet, looking off at about 50 feet out of where the wolves are out there looking at the sheep. And whereas normally the shepherd would be tending to the little sheep, shepherd's alert there with the staff, watching the wolves. Safest place to be there at the foot of the shepherd. Okay. He may not be paying attention to you think, but in this case, it's worth it because he's paying attention to the enemy. The safest place is there is in the love of God, the freedom of God. Okay, so live without fear, and whose lives not only have a spiritual foundation in this way, but a psychological one as well, in that their love for God will show itself in an ordered way of life and service to others. Okay? In other words, the best prevention against disease is health. Right? That's the best prevention, is to stay healthy. Stay healthy. Stay close to God, the source of help, and make that happen. Third bullet. These bad spirits, the malevolent spirits, are more subtle than us. Genesis 3. Remember the serpent? Subtle. And human truth discernment may not be an adequate defense against superior deception abilities. The information which the spirits quote here, the information which the spirits give in New Age channeling, which is a type of medium, spiritism, is a supernaturally sophisticated mixture of truth and error, which their followers are incapable of evaluating. See, I can be manipulated by human subtlety and language. You know, the good spin doctors do this to me all the time. I buy a lot of stuff I don't need. Please. Right. Yeah. Well, the personality assessments are generally are constructive. They don't seem to be... I can't find anything in them that looks strange. You know, you always have the issue of self-deception. You know, I can take tests and skew the results in the way I want them. You know, I can look a whole lot better because you're playing that game about what does the evaluator want to hear here, especially in a management context. Yes, I would gladly give my life for the company's profit per share this quarter. Oh, easily. Right. I already do, it seems like. 2 quarts of blood a day, it seems like. Yeah. But some of the tests, of course, you know, like the MMPI, those kind of tests catch us. They'll ask the same question in different ways to see if we're trying to manipulate. So the smart ones will take advantage of recognizing the reality of self-deception as well as self-ignorance. I mean, sometimes you'll get a question where you sit there and say, well, I don't know how I feel about this. I really don't know whether I'd rather be a forest ranger or a whale watcher. Yeah, I don't have any strong feelings one way or the other, you know. So, on those that are psychologically based and things like this, you know, I don't know of any test over in that side, and I'm only familiar with probably 10 or 15 of them that they don't look bad. They don't look like they have any negative impact because they're assessing my spirit and my thing of this type. When you get all the horoscopes, you know, that's clearly tied to astrology and stuff like that. You know, and it's a little less indicated as a danger until one starts worshiping it. You know, I mean. It's comical. Mine always runs opposite. You know, I read it about 4 times a year, you know, when there's nothing else on the page left, you know. But it's always a comical kind of thing. But it's a great example of how pagan prophecy works, by the way. Because a pagan prophecies in the Old Testament were always vague, right? And you would always see yourself in there. You'd take all these phrases. That's talking about Martha, you know. And it was talking about, someone from your past will contact you within the next 12 years. And then, you know, in the 12 years, that must have been Martha. You know, this kind of thing. So there's a lot of strangeness that goes on there. But we do have a problem with astrology that, at least in the time we're talking, they did believe that the angels were the gods of the stars. So they did star worship, sun worship, moon worship, because they were thought to be deities. And that was part of where the whole horoscope, since everything was controlled by the stars, that's why the horoscopes, that's how you knew fate. And as we mentioned probably in the first time we started this series, that these passages we looked at in Colossians and Ephesians that started this series off, okay, they were about trying to encourage new Christians in these contexts that had been taught all their life that the stars controlled their destiny, that there was no escape from fate. It was all determined. Hopeless. I could never better my condition. I could never grow and improve. I mean, it was all controlled by these impersonal forces that didn't like me most of the time. There was no hope. And so the message of Paul in these epistles that we've been looking at specifically says, no, no. Whatever power we thought they had or in some cases actually did have, broken at the cross. You want freedom? Come grab a hold of Jesus. You want freedom? And that doesn't apply. There's none of that element involved. Didn't it? The other piece of this, see, is this is one of the major, a lot of debate about this, but one of the basic distinctions between magic and true religion is whose will is getting done here. In magic, remember, I'll manipulate God to get what I want. Sorcery is all about that. I'll sit there, and of course, we'll take prayer this way sometimes, right? You know, you have not because you ask not, and then, yeah, well, I tried that. I tried asking for this stuff, but you didn't get it because you asked it for the wrong reason. So you, quote-unquote, in the King James, consume it upon your lust, right? And so there's that element that we'll try to manipulate. And, we do this all the time. We do this in human relationships, right? There's this reciprocity. There's this mutualness associated with relationships where when I serve somebody else, they're also supposed to serve me back. I'm not supposed to start that way. Well, I'll start serving you when you start serving me. You know, it's not supposed to be that way. You're supposed to lead like God leads. He sends his rain on the just and the unjust alike. Right? You're supposed to lead with the goodness. This kind of thing. But in magic and sorcery, you have that opposite kind of scenario. I want to use these forces for me, specifically. Right? We have billions of incantations back out there, but so rarely do you have a magical incantation or a prayer for the welfare of somebody else. You know, it's always them or their vested interest is what they're invoking a local deity for or something of that type. So it's a very real issue about the self-centeredness. I remember somebody was saying, you know, that they talked about themselves all day long, all in one conversation. They'd say, well, that's enough about me. What do you think about me? You know, that kind of model, you know. So equal time, you know, for this self-aggrandizing model, right? So that's a very real issue, and that's part of what distinguishes. That's why in that one you almost never get the phrase, your will be done. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Submission. I mean, yeah, the values of me understanding exactly where I am in my relationship with God and where my true significance fits in that relationship. You know, it's like all the arrogant kings of the Old Testament world. You know, half the time they were accused saying, "I am God, and there is none else." King of Tyre, for example. Right? I am God, and there is none else. Right. Yeah. What I'm talking about in this particular case is the full boat. Deception. Anybody can be deceived by these creatures, Christian, non-Christian. Because we're constantly warned in the New Testament to avoid deception by this evil kingdom. Romans 6 says, okay, you escape slavery and the deception. Now, don't go voluntarily do it. Right? Second half said, shall we continue to sin that grace may abound? So there's a model at the deception level, but that's not even remotely possession. I mean, possession is literally taking over the body. And what we're really talking about here is more deception than anything else. I mean, it's a real phenomena. And we get fuzzy because we're stepping over in a spiritual world. We're going off the podium and we may fall flat on our face because we don't know a lot about it. But we do know that they, like I say, they are deceivers of us. And we're sort of approaching some of the places where this occurs in this text. But yeah, I'm talking about the full boat. Fairly obvious where it's not me at all. I'm locked in a cage and imprisoned or something of that type as a consciousness. So the more overt ones. Now, their interface here, which is, well, it's a good segue here. The external spirits could interface directly with our minds in a number of ways. And these are just some of the ways. They're probably more and better ones that I'm not aware of. But these are the ones that come out of the literature. The first one is they could energize certain psychological processes, so they become dominant. Psychological processes require energy, and this energy may be supplied not only by the psyche, me, and the Holy Spirit, but conceivably also by demonic forces. Such an agency could enter the ego especially, and perhaps only, if the decision-making functions were voluntarily given over and began to act in a completely anti-ego or against myself manner. All right. Now, the point of that is saying is that, you know, the fact my thinking processes and my decision-making processes require energy. I burn not a whole lot of calories, I have discovered, but I burn some calories when I think. And I certainly get tired after trying the very simple and elemental thoughts. But it takes energy to do these kinds of things. And in these kind of scenarios, where I focus on, I think about this in terms of like when you focus on something, you repeat it over and over and it gets stronger. It gets stronger. It starts dominating. You think when you're worried about a problem, and you dream about it, and it intrudes at the time you're supposed to be doing your business. You know, it's there. That's one of those energy processes. That's one of these psychological processes that's energized. It's got energy to stay there, and it keeps thinking in background, so to speak. Okay? And that's one of the places where deception could occur. I could pick a particularly bad thought. I would like to be this kind of person, in a non-God kind of person. And then if I think about that long enough, theoretically, I could energize that to where it stays dominant and starts affecting the way I think. It's like, remember those things you don't resolve, the problems with another person that you don't resolve, and you put it off, and then over time you forget about it, but it's already made you bitter, you know, and negative toward that person, and now you can't remember why you don't like this person anymore. Whereas you had, God gave you several weeks to deal with this issue when it was still very much on your mind, but now it just becomes part of who you are. It's that kind of model. The second place is dream states. Dream states have always been frequent meeting places for human spirit communication, including angel visitations. Most of the revelation that God gave in the Old Testament were through dream visions. And in some cases, this next one, but a lot of it's, thank you. A lot of it's dream states. I mean, he did a lot of communication to kings during dreams, and would have Daniel come in and interpret some of these. The dream state, as you know as well as I do, that's a weird place. That's a weird place. The dream state's a weird place. And I'm not talking about daydreams. Those aren't as weird, generally. But the real dreams are strange, strange places. And it's one of those strange interface places. The next one's called altered states of consciousness. Open up to us vast possibilities of influence and input. There are trance states that are akin to dreaming and are part of our most institutional possession. They are known as the gateway to ASCs, altered states of consciousness. ASCs are considered the meeting place with the spirits in most cultures. Meditative states are similar to trance states in brain chemistry and behavior and gateway and can be induced by repetition and ritual. Obsessive reflection on an anti-value, such as ambition or power, can induce this state. Joshua 1:8, do not let this book of the law depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful. Visionary artists and powerful opinion makers can almost live in a constant ASC for periods, allowing our culture to be influenced by their muses. Now, let me explain that terminology. Okay? Basically, there's a state that the human brain can enter called a trance state. And it's a trance, and you get into it by everything from high periods of stress to powerful rhythmic music, to overloading the nervous system, to certain types of psychoactive drugs. There's a number of ways to get into it. You can train yourself to get into it, whether you believe in it or not, period. But in the trance state, the world looks different to you, either physically, perceptually, like the shamans. They'll see the animals come out of the forest and converse with them, and the plants say, yeah, if you want to make a stronger drug mixture, add this plant species to the mixture. Now, sometimes it's perceptual, but sometimes it's only moral. Sometimes the world, moral. Sometimes it only looks like the most important thing in life is to become boss. Sometimes it's more important to do X than Y. It's not. In other words, it has a different, the landscape looks different, moral. This, which used to be so obviously is more important than this, now doesn't look as quite as important. These changes can get there, and some of the techniques that are used are mantras, where I say something over and over and over. Remember, I think I told you the story. I had a boss, a fiercely competitive individual, and I'm not accusing him of any of this, but every morning he would come in to his office, and he would open his top drawer, and he'd pull out this plaque thing, or this black-looking thing, and he'd read it, and they put it, and he started every day with this ritual. He would read this thing and just put it back in there. And he was from the Midwest, and I was from the South, so I asked him over a while. He grew up in the northern Midwest, actually. After about a year of working for him, I had to ask him as we bonded. I said, what is this thing that you read every morning like a religious ritual? And he said, I'll show you. He calls me and closes the door like it's super secret, right? And he pulls this out, and all it says is, the scenery never changes until you're the lead dog. Now, and I grew up in the South, so I'd never seen a team of sled dogs, right, where everybody that's behind the leader is looking up at somebody's rear, right, and the only one that get a change of scenery ever are the two that are the lead dog, right, okay. And so this was this guiding principle of this guy, right? That, and it was, like I say, it looked like a religious ritual, you know, and it was, we had a nice laugh over it, but I think about that subsequently. You know, I come back and I say, this is, you know, a lot of executive leadership, you know, they've got mantras like that. They've got expressions that if you say them long enough, they become a value, and if you say them, continue to say them, they become God. You know, where everything needs to be put at the, laid at the altar of this, family, friend, value, morals, ethics, legal consideration, right? You can still be one of those. Well, you know, well, that's a classical case. Anybody, any zealot, right, on our side, their side, this side, whatever, falls into that category. The same thing we've been talking about consistent repetition of something to where, over time, of course, even if it started and you knew it was wrong, if you say it long enough, it becomes right. Okay? You get convinced of it. You're not sure necessarily how you knew that this was true, but you're just convinced that, gosh, this is more obvious than anything in my life. Right? And some of it's just downright scary what you can be convinced of. So, good point there. Okay, altered states. We process tons and tons of unconscious data every day, and we know that this stuff is retained and affects our attitudes and behavior. There's a tons of stuff that I see just riding down the highway, you know, or on the newspaper, you know, or on the TV that just I don't pay attention to, but guess what? It affects me. We know this from studies. People remember stuff under anesthesia. People remember this stuff under anesthesia. We know electromagnetic fields can produce a wide range of religious and euphoric experiences. There's no reason why a spirit couldn't produce one of these out of the thin air. No reason whatsoever. We have one case that I documented in the thing of a Canadian healer that can go over to a test tube of trypsin, which is a healing agent in the body, and grab the tube and it becomes active, as if there were, somebody put an 8,000 Gauss magnetic field. Start. Cut field mice heal in the hand of this individual faster than in the hand of just a student. No slur on students. But on the hand of students or in the same temperature. In cloth in the same temperature. Yeah, that's out of California, actually. Yeah. There's weirdness like this. I mean, but it's very exceptionally rare. That's the point. That's why it attracts attention, because it just doesn't occur all the time. It's just particularly rare. No, this is a different. Yeah, this is somebody different. Well, at least this one has gone through a center out here, so I don't know enough about the Reiki to track to see how different and what ways. This was just one case of, I only looked at it from the standpoint of a field demonstration. There are other cases we have that support some kind of field aspect, but in possession, what occurs is there's a change in the electrostatic, the electrical firing patterns in the body, not just the brain. So we know. 2 minutes, so you'll have to go check the tank article out for that. Okay, but it basically, you know, if we had a strobing light back here, my brain would fire in a certain pattern, okay, whether I've paid attention to it or not. If I get an altered personality through a multi-personality disorder or a dissociative identity or a spirit possession, my brain will fire different personality. We have situations where alters are allergic to nylon and the regular person's not. I mean, there's enough difference in the electrochemical mix in the body when we have different states of personality to at least suggest that this is one of the possible ways of interface. Actually, I can ask you, if you check, ask me after class to look that up for you, and I'll try to find that. Same thing goes for when our brains are pharmacologically challenged via psychoactive drugs. We have no power over what we see. What typically happens in all of these scenarios is half of the content comes from us. At least half of the content comes from our unconscious or subconscious, but there are elements that don't. In other words, the deceiver out there will take our categories and dress up in those. Okay, so that we recognize sort of that it's a power, that it fits and it makes sense to us. And probably many other ways of which we cannot fathom with our current knowledge of neurobiology. Satan in Job 1 to 2, Satan had immense powers over Job's physiology, could attack him with various types of disease, could control winds, could control marauders, could stir up enemies. There were all kinds of things that somehow could be at their disposal that we're not aware of. Okay? But the most common form of deception that they use is a word from a respected role model. The most common way I am deceived is by somebody I look up to that gives me a gospel. It's, oh, yes, I'd like to be like them, and I'm going to put that into practice. That's the most common method of deception we've got in the Bible, is that of false teachers. False friends, those that lead us astray, by bad character, bad manners, but they're successful. But they're successful. That's part of why we buy in. It apparently works. When Israel went after foreign gods around the exile, they said, well, we worshipped God, we didn't get our crops, things didn't work good while we were serving God, so since that failed, we'll go worship other gods, the gods of the nations that are conquering us. See how the model worked? In other words, they assumed that what they were doing was correct, and God didn't bless them, that he didn't keep his part of the bargain, that they kept their part of the bargain. And perhaps that's a little too close to home for us, but we live in this world, too. We live in that world, too, of trying to understand that reality. So this is our stopping point. We're going to close in prayer. We get into the next one about how these angelic powers that we've been talking about on us ourselves and through friends. We get into the social and governmental dimensions of it next week, about how these things, remember we were talking about how in Daniel, how they interface up there. We're going to talk about, we've got a sample, the next one, the next page is that if I were on that side playing devil's advocate, how would I strategically plan out a way to overcome a culture and keep them in enslavement and deception all their lives? And it's not that difficult if I can come up with one. Believe me. So we should, as people, be so thankful, one, that God freed us from this because of the cross and protects us daily from this. I got to go over one more minute. One of the scariest accounts, to my mind, and it's a call, a wake-up call, was in one of the cases, several of the cases, of actual demonic possession. An exorcist, like a priest or a minister, goes in with a counselor or psychiatrist, because the psychiatrists call a lot of ministers in on cases that are they consider to be like this. They go in, and immediately the spirit in the possessed starts recounting all the bad things that the exorcist has done in their life. They start bringing up all the bad things of their life. One called it my most intimate personal details. The other called it things I did as a youth, the wild and reckless youth. And so they have this reservoir of knowledge. Now, I don't know you, but I'm terrified. I would be terrified if that happened to me. Good grace, I have so much things I'm embarrassed about in my life. That's ridiculous, right? But the fact that this is at their disposal, right? I sit there and I think before God, look, you have forgiven every one of these sons because of what your son did. And I don't want to have to remember me either, Lord. They're a pain in my memory. But we as Christians are still so dependent upon his intervention, his protective care, that shepherd with the staff, watching what they do, because we don't have the upper hand. Fortunately, he has it. And our confidence for where food comes, where rent money comes, everything, it all comes from him. And we are so unaware of the depth of that love, the depth of that power, exceedingly abundantly above all we ask or think. And that is the warmth of the love in which we live, that protection. That's why we can, as 2 and 3 year olds, we can dance in the streets, even though your mama sometimes tells you not to dance in the streets. You know, streets of Jerusalem, they can dance in the streets. God's saying, And this is because of the cross. It was hard fought. It was paid for. That was the depth of that love that brought it to us. So let's close in prayer. Father, we can never thank you enough for your tender care for us. You set all this up. We wouldn't have to mess with this, but we messed it up. We still mess it. We get involved in things we shouldn't do. We get doing mantras and wisdom slogans and things like this and turn into rules and laws and false gods. Lord, help us dethrone those this week. Show us idolatry. Show us where we're off base, Lord. Where somehow the basics of loving the Lord our God with all our heart and mind and soul and our neighbors ourselves. Show us where we have violated that we've created our own law. Give us comfort in you and an understanding greater and dependency upon you because of your love for us through your Son. May we walk and honor him more for what he did and his consistent victory over those forces in our life. We love you. We want to honor you. We want to be more like your heart. Help us forgive one another and be less prone to judgment this week.